In the recent 8-1 ruling in Snyder versus Phelps, the Supreme Court affirmed that the First Amendment precluded the imposition of tort liability on the Westboro Baptist Church for their protest at the funeral of Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder. Writing for the court, Chief Justice Roberts observed that the signs displayed by church members might not qualify as refined social or political commentary, but did nonetheless address matters of public import, such as the political and moral conduct of the United States and its citizens, the fate of our nation, homosexuality in the military, and scandals involving the Catholic clergy. The First Amendment has probably spawned more Supreme Court cases than any other provision in the U.S. Constitution, and the resulting decisions are often unpopular. What are the latest First Amendment cases to come before the court, and what are their outcomes or their likely outcomes? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
What circumstances in the Phelps case led the Supreme Court to decide that the funeral protests of the Westboro Baptist Church are protected by the First Amendment? What is your right to carry a rosary in school? And what are the consequences if you call someone a fat slob? Does the First Amendment come into play or not? With us again today is Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at the UW-Madison and the author of various books, including Speech, Conduct, and the First Amendment.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me.
As we've watched the events unfold here in Madison with sort of historic protests and all kinds of court cases, I've been wondering what sort of First Amendment implications there might be. Let me start by just reading the First Amendment and then asking you to comment on what, if any, relevance the First Amendment has to all the things we've been watching over the last few weeks right here in Madison. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Well, I think what's striking about the events in Madison in the last few weeks is that we're seeing the First Amendment in action all around us. Some of the protesters like to chant, "This is what democracy looks like." I keep thinking, "This is what the First Amendment looks like." Obviously, we've seen assembly and petition and a great deal of speech, some of it quite raucous. We've also seen some focus on very particular issues that get to sort of more technical aspects of the First Amendment, one of which is that we, the courts, really try very hard to bend over backwards to protect speech when it takes place in public spaces. And that's what the Phelps case that Norman was talking about is all about. The Supreme Court had no trouble disposing of that case. It was an 8-1 decision. And while it's true that the issue of the speech, that the speech related to matters of public interest and public import was relevant, the main outcome, the main determinant of the outcome was merely the fact that it took place in a public space and that there was no particular regulation setting aside that space as anything other than public. And that's what we've seen at the Capitol all along. In the Madison case, there are additional protections that derive from the Wisconsin State Constitution. And as far as legal controversies over access to the Capitol and the ability to assemble and to speak freely go, most of the issues in Madison have to do with Wisconsin state law and the Wisconsin State Constitution. But it has certainly been interesting and entertaining to see how these provisions of the Free Speech Clause and the Free Assembly Clause and so on, the more political aspects of the First Amendment, come to the fore every time there's a controversy. We go through long periods of time when we're not really thinking about them very much. But as soon as there's a controversy about something else, let's say a budget or perhaps a war, all of a sudden we realize once again how central these free speech rights are to the operating of our political process.
And I've heard you mention, Howard, I believe in previous conversations, I've heard you mention this term fighting words. Would that never apply in a case like this? Let's go back to the Westboro case, the Phelps case for a minute and say even if these picketers are on public property, if they say or have in their placards something that could be deemed inflammatory, is that still protected?
Well, the fighting words doctrine is relevant. And the other case that we were talking about that it connects to is the fat slob case, as we're calling it. That's a case out of Kentucky in which in the course of a dispute over a development permit, the developer seeking the permit referred to a police officer as a fat slob and was promptly arrested. The fighting words doctrine goes back to the 1940s in a case called Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire. And the idea is that while we are protected in expressing opinions of any kind, no matter how outrageous or offensive they might be, we are not protected in saying things that would cause the that we would reasonably expect to cause an average person to want to punch us in the nose. Words that provoke violence as opposed to inciting violence. But what's interesting about the history of cases involving fighting words is that almost always when those cases come up, the issue involves something someone has said to a cop. Apparently, police officers are particularly likely to want to punch us in the nose for saying the wrong sorts of things, such as calling them fat slobs. In the Kentucky case, the man who was arrested sued for false arrest. That was thrown out of court, but a court of appeals has sent it back for reconsideration. In the Phelps case, the picketer's case, that could have been an issue. The Supreme Court, Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion, pointed out that the protesters were not speaking directly in a face-to-face way to the people at the funeral. They were not standing right there in front of them. Roberts even made the point that it couldn't be proved that people attending the funeral had actually seen these signs while the funeral service was going on. And that's what separates that case from a real fighting words case. Fighting words have to be addressed face-to-face, directly to someone, with the consequence that we would expect that right there on the spot, it would provoke violence.
So if, for example, if let's say these people are picketing at the White House, I actually encountered them at the White House last fall, a place where you might expect reasonably a lot of military people to be, but not their responsibility if military just happened to be in that same public space or passing through that public space when they're picketing?
That's right. Members of the military or many other people. I don't think one has to be military to be offended by the signs that the Westboro Baptist Church is fond of displaying. We all have the responsibility to, as the saying goes, avert our eyes. Unless they're getting in our face, or the term the court used, face-to-face communication, it's our job to not to be offended and to walk away, not their job to avoid giving offense.
But what about the idea of hate speech? Because in some instances, you've got the funeral of a soldier. Family is gathering, they're grieving, and then, you know, just a few yards away, 500 yards or whatever it is, there are signs that says you know, God hates fags or homosexuals must die or, you know, that are making it sound as if it's a good thing if the person has died or blasting the whole military for having any homosexuals and so on. And at what point does it become hate speech?
Well, actually, the idea of hate speech is one that's been talked about a great deal for a number of years now. It has never done very well in the courts. In a 1992 case called R.A.V., Justice Scalia laid out a doctrine that makes it very, very difficult to have constitutionally sustainable laws that prosecute hate speech. Essentially, what he argued was that any law that targets speech in a way that would burden one side more than another side is presumptively invalid, even if the law is only reaching speech that would otherwise be unprotected, such as fighting words. So, for example, any law about hate speech that says something to the effect of one may not display signs casting aspersions on homosexuals would almost certainly be unconstitutional because it singles out messages that are negative about a particular group, homosexuals. So while it's true in public we talk about hate speech a great deal, and when universities try to establish campus speech codes, they talk about hate speech a great deal. As a constitutional matter, the courts have taken a very dim view of attempts to regulate that kind of speech, which is why campus speech codes have tended to be struck down and why city ordinances trying to do the same thing have also not fared well.
But a funeral, how is that a public event? I mean,
The funeral is not a public event, but the protesters were standing on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
There's a technical term here, which is forum. When we talk about whether a place is public or somewhat public or not at all public, the word that the courts use is it a public – the phrase that they use, is it a public forum, a limited forum, or a private forum? A sidewalk or a state capitol building, for that matter, are quintessential examples of a public forum. And in those places, the government has to tread especially lightly in trying to restrict what the expression.
So if that sidewalk is right outside a church where that funeral is in progress, that speech is still protected?
Probably. There are a line of cases that allow governments to establish special rules for special places. These were a series of cases in the 1990s involving abortion clinics. And the state of Colorado, for example, established a law preventing certain forms of protest within 500 feet of an abortion clinic. And that was upheld. But generally speaking, what you say is correct. That is, generally speaking, if you're on a sidewalk or another traditional public environment, traditional public forum, the state is going to have to meet a very high burden to justify its regulations, And those regulations have to be content neutral. And this is, again, a problem with most attempts at hate speech regulation. When we're talking about rules that limit expression in a public forum, there's an essentially absolute requirement. Not literally absolute, but as close as no matter, to an absolute requirement that the rules cannot discriminate between different content. So you can't say no one can protest on matters having to do with a war, but permit people to protest on matters having to do with a budget.
It's that same sort of constitutional approach where you can't delineate everything. You have to describe the overall situation without getting into bogging down with distinguishing the specifics a lot of times.
That's right. The technical phrase is content neutral time, place, and manner restrictions. So for example, and let's go back to the Wisconsin case with the Assembly, there have been a number of cases in which the Supreme Court has upheld rules limiting protests because protest is not considered a content, it's a form of expression. They have struck down laws that prohibited all protests near a school except for those having to do with teachers' unions, for example, because there you're specifying a particular content. So during the protests at the Capitol, my understanding is it was the Capitol Police who closed all the entrances but two to the Capitol building for protesters. And again, my understanding is that people who identify themselves as non-protesters were at least sometimes permitted to enter through other entrances. There are a great number of facts in that story about which I don't know the specific details, but if that were the way things had actually worked, that would probably be okay. That is, restrictions on protesters, as long as you don't distinguish between, say, pro-Walker and anti-Walker protesters, that's permissible in a public space.
Well, if I have a sign right in front of where you're speaking and it says Howard Schwaber is a fat slob, can you sue me for slander?
Well, conceivably, since it's printed on a sign, I suppose technically it would be libel. The question would then, of course, be whether I am, in fact, a fat slob. But,
sure. But can I say any – I mean, what are the limits to what I can say about you on a sign or shouting within your presence?
Well, there we get into a sort of a complicated mess of issues because thus far we've been talking about the question of whether a state or locality can pass a law making it a crime to engage in certain speech. There's a different set of questions that arise on the question of can I sue you? And in fact, in the Phelps case, that was a question about a civil law, a tort suit for the intentional infliction of emotional distress. There, the general rule, and I'm being somewhat very general here, is that if allowing civil lawsuits to go forward would have the effect of suppressing expression, those are also not acceptable. But libeling or slandering an individual person is different from speech on a matter of public interest. That's where that discussion in the majority's in Phelps' majority's opinion comes into play. So declaring that Howard Schwaber is a fat slob probably is not protected unless I'm a public figure. And actually, it isn't really protected then either. It's just that the standards for proving libel become very, very difficult. Public figures have to prove, in order to succeed in a libel lawsuit, have to prove that the person making the statement either knowingly was saying something false or speaking with reckless disregard of the truth, which in the case of describing me that way, I might qualify. But in general, that's a very, very it is a very high standard and one that's very difficult to meet. On the other hand, if I'm a private person, then my ability to sue you for saying false things about me is not limited. To win, I would have to show that your statements had caused damage to my reputation in a way that had caused me harm, and that would probably be difficult in the case of a fat slob.
But let's say, for example, that you are in the habit of writing editorials in the New York Times and I call you a fat slob. You become a public figure, don't you?
Well, perhaps. We have a faculty member here at the University of Wisconsin who's written recently an editorial in the New York Times, William Cronin. There is no question that people who agree or disagree with Professor Cronin are perfectly free to call him a fat slob verbally or in writing. And frankly, it is unimaginably unlikely that he could ever successfully sue one of them for libel because he would have to show that it somehow damaged his career or his reputation.
But his case brings up another interesting question because with the request for his email records, is that then a sort of First Amendment issue, the idea that if you write something negative, in this case about the Republican Party in Wisconsin, and the Republican Party wants then access to all his emails, is his email correspondence protected in any way?
That case is really interesting. It's not a court case, but that issue is terrifically interesting. Let me start by saying that as a matter of First Amendment doctrine, the answer is almost certainly that he is not protected, that his emails are not protected. But that doesn't really get to the question. The First Amendment dimensions of the Cronin case have to do with a much broader principle. Open records laws were designed to make sure that government would remain transparent and to hold power accountable. Open records laws allow ordinary citizens to find out what the government is doing and express their opinion about that. They've become something else. Those laws have become a weapon that can be deployed against any public employee. They've been used to harass school teachers, sometimes for reasons that look more like petty, vindictive disputes between parents and a teacher, situations of that sort. And they have become a weapon to silence one's political opponents. I want to take care to point out that these laws have been used this way by both liberals and conservatives in Wisconsin in recent years. This is not by any means something unique to conservatives or unique to this controversy. It's been going on for a long time. It does, to my mind, represent a real perversion of the purposes for which open record laws were created, and it does have First Amendment dimensions. Ordinarily, the Republican Party would be perfectly able to describe William Cronin publicly as a fat slob. They could emblazon it on the front of a newspaper, or slightly more to the point, to accuse him of misrepresenting the case or of being inaccurate or of being dishonest or of being wrong. And there'd be nothing wrong with any of that. Because of the open record laws, they can do something else. They can use the machinery of the state. And again, let me emphasize, liberal groups and groups affiliated with the Democratic Party have done this in the past. They can use the machinery of the state to go on fishing expeditions to find destructive material. These are very burdensome requests. They can be very costly to comply with. They can take a great deal of time and effort, both for the individual who's targeted and for the university.
To dig out all emails sent by this person?
Right. It isn't quite true that the Republican Party asked for all of William Cronin's emails. They asked for all of William Cronin's emails that mentioned, and there was a long list of names and terms and whatnot. Someone has to go through all those emails. In my case, I'm projecting, but if this mm-hmm. were me, we'd be talking about well over 1,000 emails and filter them for these terms. I'm sure there are computer programs that can do that, but it's nonetheless a laborious and expensive process. And so the open record laws have gone from being a mechanism to allow ordinary citizens to hold our government accountable to allow private citizens to use the powers of government to silence people or to intimidate people. And to my mind, that has profound First Amendment implications, because that's exactly what all these other cases we're talking about have pointed to as the evil to be avoided. You don't want the state to be in the business of silencing criticism of other individuals or of the government itself or of officials or of positions or of issues. And while it's not the government that brought this request, although the guy from the Republican Party whose name is on the request is listed on a website as a current employee of the governor's office, so I'm not sure about that. But assuming for the moment that this was a request brought by a genuine private party, it's nonetheless the case that he's able to use these laws and the courts to enforce these laws and government offices to pursue these requests in ways that have nothing to do with furthering or expanding free expression, but rather have to do with suppressing it.
Likely to end up before the Supreme Court in some form?
No, probably not. It might eventually end up before the state Supreme Court if, for example, the university were to decide to contest this request very vigorously. In the past, the university council's office and both Republican and Democratic gubernatorial administrations, again, I want to emphasize this cuts across party lines, have accepted the position that open records laws can be used in this way and that they should be responded to without much resistance and in a very thorough way. There's a very recent case from just over a year ago called Schill. I don't actually have the full name in front of me. I apologize for that. Which the Wisconsin Supreme Court said those requests are limited to communications that have something to do with the performance of official duties. So there's a bit of a saving grace there. But unless it gets to be the case that someone, in this instance the university, wants to really have a fight about the purpose and meaning of these laws at a really basic level, it is unlikely that the state Supreme Court will have the opportunity to change their view. And one last thing, the state Supreme Court, in a series of cases over a number of years, has likewise accepted the proposition that every school teacher, every janitor, every police officer, and every university faculty member is a proper subject for an open records request.
Well, so if, as you say, this open records law can be used as a weapon to squelch...
Can be and has been.
...to squelch free speech, wouldn't the Supreme Court ultimately... decide on the applicability of this open records law?
It would require rethinking some basic categories. Previously, we talked about public and non-public forums. Another piece of this is the state action doctrine. Right? The principle is that the First Amendment only limits what government does. In this instance, or in the instances we're talking about, it appears at least that these are not actions of government. These are actions by private citizens. I'm trying to bring to bear the point that government is involved here because of the operations of these laws. I would be delighted to see a case like this go to the U.S. Supreme Court. I would be delighted to help someone bring one if they wanted my help. But I don't see that as an immediate likelihood.
I think it also, if I remember right from some of the articles I've seen about it and also what Bill Cronin has written himself, isn't there an issue that the request for these records would collide with some of the privacy acts that protect, for example, student grades, student records? Certain things, because if you are a faculty member and you have in your email correspondence things going back and forth with students, back and forth with colleagues who are involved in tenure cases or other things, some of that potentially I would think would be confidential.
Absolutely. And the university administration, I don't mean to misstate their position, takes the position that they have to engage in a balancing test with respect to particular email communications to see whether issues of academic freedom or issues of privacy are involved. It's a very murky area, and I must say that the statutes as written do not very clearly delineate what the standards need to be. And for that matter, thus far, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court hasn't really completely delineated what happens when these different legal principles clash. This particular request that's been sent to Cronin is getting enough attention and causing enough furor, and maybe more to the point, is taking place against the background of so much political contention that perhaps this case will have legs, as they say, and become the basis for some new rules.
We're going to look, speaking of politics, at campaign finance and the First Amendment when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Howard Schwaber, who is looking at some of the latest issues involving the First Amendment with us, and we've been looking so far at free speech. You wouldn't think right off the bat that campaign finance would be a free speech issue, but it does fall into that category.
You might not think that if you hadn't studied the cases. What happened is back in the early 1970s, the U.S. Supreme Court was considering, in a case called Buckley versus Valeo, which is sort of the grandfather of all campaign finance cases, was considering restrictions on expenditures, how much money candidates could spend either of their own or from their campaign funds on their campaigns. And in that context, the Supreme Court declared that money is speech, or more specifically, that the expenditure of money is speech. Before I go any further, let me take a moment to suggest that I think that's wrong. It is what the Supreme Court has said, and they've continued to say it, and they said it recently in the Citizens United case that we all know and love. But for what it's worth, I still think it's wrong. I think the more accurate description is that money amplifies speech.
It certainly does that.
I think money is the megaphone, not the actual voice.
You mean in terms of money buying commercial airwaves and
Sure, buying commercials on television, buying ads in the newspaper, buying signs.
You can get the message out no matter what, but it's just that very few people will hear it or see it unless you have the financing to put it on the media.
And if the court had thought about money as a mechanism to amplify speech rather than thinking of the expenditure of money as actually being an act of speech itself, that would have led to very, very different results. Because there's a long-standing tradition that we've actually already talked about, which is that even in a public forum, you can have rules as long as they're neutral and as long as they serve an important interest. And the classic case of those rules comes from a case called Kovach back in the 1940s, involved sound trucks. Before there was television and before there was the internet, the way a candidate would get his message across was by loading up a truck with lots of loudspeakers and driving down the street blaring, "Vote for Joe." And towns made rules that they didn't want these sound trucks traveling through residential neighborhoods. And the Supreme Court upheld that rule. Noise is a classic. Other cases involved a rock concert held in New York Central Park that violated a noise ordinance. There was a case that involved protesters who wanted to stay overnight at the Washington Monument. In all of these cases, the court had no trouble saying, look, you're perfectly free to express your message, but you can't use or we will uphold limits on using this particular means to do so. And to my way of thinking, the expenditure of money is much more on that order. It's something that amplifies a message or gets it somewhere or conveys it. It's not the expression itself. But that's not how the court has always seen it. The court since the 70s has seen the expenditure of money as speech. And so when we get to Citizens United, for example, we have a situation that, viewed through that lens, sees corporations being told, you may not express yourselves in certain ways, in certain contexts.
By, say, backing a certain candidate.
By unlimited expenditures to purchase advertisements to back a certain candidate who is named in the advertisements. Free speech, campaign finance law is a thicket of technical rules, many of which are relatively easy to evade. Citizens United did far less in and of itself than people think, only because the rules that were already in place were tissue paper thin. Courts were having to hear cases arguing over things like, is there a difference between a case that says vote against the incumbent senator and vote against Feingold? Does the fact that his name is included change the nature of the expression? And they had all these sort of magic words tests. So in one way, the only thing Citizens United actually did for campaign expenditures is get rid of some of those fairly formalistic and, frankly, fairly silly rules.
Now, is the fact, I believe I have this right, that a corporation is legally an individual?
Well, there we get to something more complex. It does. And that's the sense in which Citizens United perhaps has more substance and deserves some of the attention that it's getting. Let me go back just for one second and say the piece that really changed what's going on in campaigns was not Citizens United itself, but rules issued by the Federal Election Commission. The Supreme Court in Citizens United took great pains to say that there's nothing wrong with disclosure requirements. And as long as you have disclosure requirements in place, corporations have a lot of good reasons to not want to be too heavily behind a particular candidate. Their customers might not like it. Their shareholders might not like
it.
As
we have seen in Wisconsin of late.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, when you say disclosure, you mean the stuff at the end that tells you
paid
who's paying for.
By, right. And as far as the Supreme Court and Citizens United was concerned, those rules could be as strict as you wanted them to be. You could require a disclosure of everyone who contributed any money at all. It might be cumbersome, but constitutionally that would be fine. The FEC then passed rules saying, no, we will allow these corporate expenditures on advertisements to also be anonymous. And that is what has changed the landscape more than the ruling itself. But going back to your question, right, the other half was this business of treating a corporation as a person. There's presently a corporation that's running for Congress in Connecticut.
It had to be.
Well, now I don't think that they'll succeed because just this term, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case involving AT&T, had no trouble dispensing with AT&T's claim that because it's a corporate person, it has rights of privacy.
Oh,
so it's not quite the case, to be fair, that the courts have said that corporations have all the rights that persons have. They have said that corporations are treated as persons for certain purposes of constitutional rights and that one of these includes free expression. We shouldn't overstate the case. I don't think this – I can't remember the name of the corporation that's running for Congress. One of their representatives is coming to Madison sometime in the near future to give a speech, and it should be fairly funny. I don't think that they have a significant chance of withstanding a court challenge to that effort. So now we have a new campaign finance case coming out of Arizona. Arizona tried to do something different. They said, okay, we can't limit expenditures, but we can do this. We can have a public financing system. And if you accept public financing, you're limited to how much money you can get. But if your opponents who do not accept public financing spend too much more than you, then we'll give you some more money to equal the playing field.
That seems like a slippery slope.
Well, maybe. It sort of depends how you look at it.
It could be very expensive.
Oh, in that sense, absolutely. Well, it's not that Arizona didn't offer to match dollar for dollar every penny that's spent. They just said more money will be freed up to try and equalize the contest to some extent. Arizona argued that this is not suppressing speech. It's providing for more speech. At oral argument, I believe this was just 3 days ago or 2 days ago, the justices seemed unsympathetic. They seemed to take the position, and you know, this is reading tea leaves a little bit, but from their comments, it certainly sounded like they were taking the position that this is effectively punishing the candidates or their campaigns or the outside spenders who want to spend their money to express one message, and it's punishing them by giving an advantage to their opponents.
Well, and of course, by law then, under that reasoning, any opponent would be eligible for this additional funding. So even if you had only five people backing you, you could still get the whatever it is, same amount.
Well, no. To qualify for public financing in the first place, a candidate has to make a certain showing in the primaries, for example. But certainly any candidate who had qualified for and accepted public financing would be eligible. That's right. So the Supreme Court takes a very dim view of the even playing field idea. Some of the justices were openly mocking that concept. They are viewing this as a zero-sum game so that anything that advantages one side disadvantages the other And so for the state to advantage one side in response to an expenditure by the other effectively creates a disincentive for the other side to have spent that money in the first place, and that would be bad.
That's kind of related maybe to laws which may not still be in effect. I've kind of lost touch with it, but in broadcasting these, you know, fairness doctrine, equal time
the
clauses.
The late lamented fairness doctrine, yeah. Which is indeed no longer in force.
Related to free speech would be freedom of the press. Can you say anything about some of the cases involving, for example, campus newspapers?
Well, we have two, actually, one that does not involve campus newspapers and one that does. The one that does not involve campus newspapers is a case out of Florida. It's in the federal courts. It does not yet reach the U.S. Supreme Court, and it may not. But it raises a fascinating question, which has to do with shield laws. Shield laws are state laws that say that reporters don't have to reveal their sources. Or materials that they've gained confidentially in the course of investigating a story.
Often invoked.
And it's very often invoked. And in many high-profile cases, journalists become famous by being willing to go to court after a contempt citation. The limit of those laws usually is that if there's a legal proceeding that requires – in which that material is required, the court can order it to be disgorged. That's how we get these contempt citations. A court says, turn this stuff over, and a reporter says no. In Florida, the federal court – has actually taken a fairly strong line in protecting the reporters. They ruled that in a criminal prosecution of government officials for corruption, the government had not done enough to show that it really needed the material in question, and so the reporter did not have to turn it over. So that's a live issue. I should point out that the Arizona campaign finance case we're talking about, that law was adopted after a huge corruption scandal in Arizona. The countervailing interest to all of this freedom to express oneself through money is a fear of political corruption. That makes the Arizona case really remarkably central. People who fear that our electoral system has been corrupted by money should be focusing on that case very closely. But back to the press. Sorry for that digression. The other case involves a campus newspaper, and that one isn't really being brought as a free press case at all. It's being brought as a free speech case. And the reason is that school newspapers are not recognized as press by the courts. There's an old 1980s case called Hazelwood School District versus Kuhlmeier, which said that high school principals can censor high school newspapers. It was presumed following that case that college newspapers would be different, would not be subject to that level of interference.
How would you distinguish one from the other?
Primarily by the fact that college students are adults. The argument in Hazelwood was that high school students are essentially children, that maintaining a good atmosphere and discipline inside the school is a high priority for the school, and that disruptive and immature expressions by young people can disrupt school discipline. It's difficult to suggest that something printed in the Daily Cardinal or the Badger Herald would disrupt the University of Wisconsin.
Well, I can tell you that there was a headline in the Duke Chronicle. This was right after an attempt on the life of Gerald Ford. The headline was, what? Missed again?
Sure. And that's an offensive headline. And in fact, that headline is prosecutable because there are special statutes, maybe prosecutable, because of special statutes having to do with threats against the president. The University of Pennsylvania, after President Reagan was shot, there was a student reporter on the radio station who said something to the effect of, you know, I hope we get him next time, or words more or less to that effect. And he had the Secret Service camped out on his door. But it's hardly the case that in either instance the operations of the university ground to a halt. Nonetheless, in 2006, we have a Seventh Circuit case called Hostie versus Carter. This case comes out of the Governor's State University in Illinois. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit applied the Hazelwood rule to a university newspaper. They said that the, I believe it was the president of the university, some university official anyway, was perfectly within his rights to review the newspaper before it was published and force them to exclude anything he didn't want included. The reason it's not so much a press case as a free speech case goes back to that discussion we had before about public forums. Remember we talked about the area around the Capitol building or a sidewalk as a traditional public forum. And I mentioned something called a limited forum. A limited forum is different. A limited forum is a space or facility set up by the government for the purpose of allowing private expression. So if you imagine, for example, opening a city council meeting to allow citizens to take the microphone and express themselves. Or one of the most famous cases involves segregated fees systems, both here at the University of Virginia. Those cases have gone to the United States Supreme Court. So the Seventh Circuit concluded that this college newspaper is a limited forum. Now, in a limited forum, the government is perfectly free to exclude content. They can say, we don't want any stories about politics or about science or about anything they want, as long as they don't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. So you can't exclude only political columns that are critical of Governor Walker. But you can exclude all political columns. And that's what had happened here. Governor State University had a policy that its campus newspaper must be politically neutral. And in enforcing that policy, the school president took the position that he could excise any story from the paper before it was printed that had a non-neutral political content. In this particular case, the non-neutral political content was a column criticizing the university itself. So this all becomes somewhat circular. But the Seventh Circuit upheld that.
And they said the university had the right to censor?
Absolutely. They said this
because it's limited, it's a limited press run for the university, you kind of?
Well, essentially, yes. Because it's a campus paper solely for purposes of being read on the campus and run by the university, I should point out that our two main campus newspapers are not. They're both independently funded.
Yes, and that actually has led to some papers going independent, I think.
It has indeed.
Issues of that kind.
College papers that can afford to do so are well advised to go to become independent for just this reason. But as long as it's run by the university, it's the equivalent of the university opening up a lecture hall one evening and inviting students to come and express their views on, say, the sports teams and say, and therefore we don't want to hear anything political. And according to the Seventh Circuit, this college can do that with its newspaper.
Any difference between public and private institutions?
Yes. A private institution almost certainly would be able to censor its newspaper with no trouble whatsoever because, again, the First Amendment only restricts actions of government. You could easily have a federal law akin to Title IX, for example, that requires private institutions to comply with some federal principles if they want to receive private money.
Right.
But that's a much more indirect form of coercion.
Before we leave the topic of free speech, free press, et cetera, isn't there a case about beer?
There is. And I think it's a critically important case that brings to the forefront fundamental First Amendment principles. The Flying Dog Brewery in Michigan has been told by the Michigan Liquor Commission, I'm not sure I have that name exactly right, but a government entity that regulates production of alcohol, that they may not market Raging Bitch beer. And as an American and a believer in free speech, which happens to be Flying Dog's best-selling beer, as a matter of fact, and so they've sued. Claiming a violation of their free speech rights, and we certainly hope that this important principle is upheld.
What is their objection? I mean, just the word itself?
I presume they find the word offensive.
And we think that this will go how far in the court system?
Well, I was being humorous. In fact, the principle is a serious one. Uh-huh. The ability of businesses. Commercial speech in general is much less protected than other forms of speech for a variety of reasons. But that issue usually comes up in the question of laws against misleading advertising or laws. For example, there was a law at one point that liquor stores could not advertise price specials. That came out of, I believe, Rhode Island. 44 Liquor Mart was the name of that case. These cases have great names. On the other hand, choosing what to name your product comes closer to being a true free speech issue, I think.
Does this come down to like community standard at all? In other words, if...
No, it wouldn't because community standards would be involved if the name were obscene. So there are certainly some things you probably can't print on. The state can probably prevent you from printing on a beer label.
But not offensive
merely,
as the commission
merely being
is
offensive,
arguing?
Right. Merely being offensive doesn't trigger a community standard. I'll just give you the most famous case. I'm not sure I can actually say this on the radio, but it was a jacket that bore the words F the draft. And the court said, no, you cannot prevent that word from being displayed in public. And if you can't prevent that word from being displayed in public, a famous Anglo-Saxon blunt fricative referring to the Sex Act.
Well, and that's true. And there are T-shirts that I have seen right here in Wisconsin that bear that same word. So I gather
yes,
that
certainly.
Is equally protected by the First Amendment.
Well, unless Michigan wins its argument that this is the kind of commercial speech that is rightfully less protected than ordinary speech, then I would think – if Michigan wins that argument, then they can probably uphold this rule. If they lose that argument, I think the brewery has a good case.
Another area is freedom of religion. And we're going to look at those cases in a moment when we continue with University of the Air. American taxpayers are financing this unholy monument to Jewish mendacity and greed and to filthy, fag lust. Homosexuals and Jews dominated Nazi Germany. Jews are the real Nazis. That's from the statements of Reverend Phelps at a protest in 1996 at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and his hateful speech was considered protected under the First Amendment. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Howard Schwaber, and we are talking about some of the interesting cases in recent years pertaining to freedom of speech, of press, and now we're turning to freedom of religion. I just had to open with that Phelps comment because, you know, there, some of the cases have in the past, like with Skokie, Illinois, involved being able to make pretty anti-Semitic statements or, you know, say awful things that do, you know, one person's free speech may come up against somebody else's feelings about their own religion.
Well, perhaps, and leaving aside the Reverend Phelps' rather novel theory of German history, in that case, it's interesting that what distinguishes Phelps from the Nazis who wanted to march in Skokie is that Phelps asserted he was engaged in religious expression. And we do give near absolute protection to the expression of religious doctrine, no matter how bizarre it might happen to be. I don't want to say there are no exceptions to that. If I say that my religion requires me to walk up to you and say, give me your wallet or I'll shoot you, that will not be protected. But as long as it can be in any way described as some sort of doctrine or principle or abstract idea or moral standard or anything like that, our courts have gone extremely far in being willing to protect any form of religious expression. The same does not necessarily apply to religious conduct. And that's where the free exercise of religion cases tend to come down.
What about the Amish? That's often, you know, a group that runs up against conflicts with the law.
Sure. Maybe the most famous free exercise case of them all comes from right here in Wisconsin. That's Wisconsin versus Yoder. In that case, the Supreme Court said that old order Amish parents could not be compelled to send their children to public school after the eighth grade. And the reasoning was that while the law requiring parents, requiring children to go to public schools was not intended to be anti-religious, in its operation, it would put a burden on their religious practices. And until 1990, that was the standard. That is, a law that had the effect, whether intended or not, of burdening a religious practice would be unlikely to be found constitutional. It would have to satisfy what is called strict scrutiny, which is the highest and most demanding standard for constitutionality that we have. Such a law would only be constitutional if it were narrowly tailored to serve a compelling government interest. In 1990, we had a case called Smith. The full name is Employment Division, Department of Human Services, State of Oregon versus Smith, which is why we usually just call it Smith. In that case, an opinion written by Justice Scalia, the court changed those rules completely. Scalia argued that the idea that where conduct is concerned, protecting everyone's religious conduct against the operation of generally applicable laws would produce chaos and anarchy and make everyone a law unto themselves. And he said that's not an acceptable outcome. So he penned, not by himself, this was for a 5-4 majority of the court, penned an opinion that said where law is generally applicable, there's no requirement for the government to make any exception for religious practice. That case involved, for example, the consumption of peyote. Right. And there's no requirement that the government make an exception. A government that has a law against consuming peyote doesn't have to have an exception that says except unless it's for religious purposes. They may if they want to. They don't have to. And in that opinion, Justice Scalia freely conceded that the outcome of this would likely be that majority religious practices would receive these accommodations and that minority religious practices would not. But he said that's just the cost of having a democracy. That's preferable to each person being a law unto themselves. So that standard was incredibly controversial. In the first Clinton term, one of the very few moments of true bipartisanship was that the Clinton administration and the Democrats and the Republicans and Congress all got together and passed a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which said which essentially, in these words, overruled Smith and said, no, federal courts will look at any law that happens to incidentally burden a religious practice, and if there's no accommodation, they should apply strict scrutiny. The Supreme Court struck that one down 6-3. I confess I don't recall the precise vote in the case, but turned around 1 year later and struck that one down right away. So Smith is still the rule. So the current understanding that we have of the free exercise clause is that governments may allow accommodations for religious practice, but they don't have to. So that's what happened to Kenneth Dreesen. This past year, Mr. Dreesen was arrested while driving his pickup truck down a Wisconsin road going the wrong way, and police found a bag of marijuana in his truck for which he was arrested and charged. And in his defense, he insisted that he needed the marijuana for religious purposes, and he appealed his convictions on the ground that it would violate his religious freedom.
Right.
He lost.
Mm-hmm. Would he have lost if the case didn't involve the truck going down the wrong way? In other words,
he probably would have lost anyway.
But let's say he had just been in a park and engaging in his activity for religious purposes.
Well, I think the Wisconsin Court of Appeals had considerable doubt as to whether his asserted religion was a genuine one. Mm-hmm. But leaving that aside, no, he would likely have lost anyway, right? The law against marijuana, possession, use, et cetera, is a generally applicable law. No one thinks that law was invented in order to get at certain religious practices and suppress them. So that would be a classic example, as was the law against the use of peyote, of a criminal law generally applicable that is not required to make an accommodation for conduct for religious purposes.
Well, there's a line there, it seems to me, between that old, you know, rights of the individual versus infringing upon everyone else's rights to, say, safety. And so, for example, if the expression of religion is seen as something, in this case, not necessarily relevant, but causing somebody to drive the wrong way down a road, then religion, regardless, it is somehow destructive of the rights of others.
Well, perhaps. One can phrase that slightly differently and say the reason it's important that a criminal law is involved, that these are laws designed to protect public safety, and that that interest is sufficient to overcome even the old test. That is a compelling state interest.
But what about, for example, you know, animal sacrifice, which violates some, you know, cruelty to animals statute, but is considered religiously necessary?
Sure. In fact, there's a case specifically about that out of New Orleans out of Hialeah, the city of Hialeah, Florida, called the Church of Lukumu Babu'ai. I have that name slightly wrong, versus the city of Hialeah. In that case, the Supreme Court found that a law against animal sacrifice for religious purposes, that's what the law said, had been created solely in order to prevent a Santeria church from opening up shop in their town. Had the law not specified religious purposes, had the law been a general law against harming animals in period, then the enforcement of that law against the church would have been perfectly fine.
Seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it, as far as setting that law up in the first place?
Well, some of the cases don't deal with those kinds of issues. For example, there's a case right now in Kentucky, and there have been cases like this, I know, in Pennsylvania, and I believe in Wisconsin as well, in which Amish farmers don't want to have to put orange safety triangles on their buggies.
A classic.
It's a classic. And there's one case that's actually before the U.S. Supreme Court right now. This one has to do with a teacher in a religious school. And this particular teacher developed narcolepsy, was fired, and sued under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the question is, does the Americans with Disabilities Act make a separate category for religious teachers, or does it have to?
The ADA, whether that would apply in a parochial school or only in public schools.
That's correct.
Because it's a government act?
Yes, that's right.
Well, I guess that raises the question of within a parochial school, then what other government acts don't apply?
Well, that's right. And in fact, there is an ongoing controversy. And I don't have a specific case in mind, but I promise you that cases of this kind will reach the Supreme Court in the next year or two or three about the extent to which anti-discrimination laws in general apply to religious employers. Is a church required not to discriminate on the basis of religion when it hires its janitor or its teachers? There have been cases pointing in both directions and statutes written that do or do not provide these accommodations. The cases become particularly difficult when one considers things like the faith-based initiatives that received significant additional funding under the Bush administration that are still in operation. Are religious charities required to comply with the same kind of non-discrimination laws or record-keeping laws or open accounting laws that secular charities are required to comply with? There's a whole range of arguments of this kind. And these don't have to do with criminal statutes protecting the public against people driving the truck down the wrong side of the road.
Would it also apply, for example, if you have a parochial school, I assume it would have to have accessible bathrooms the way other schools would or not?
That's a good question. And you can then flip that around and say, is there a problem with the Establishment Clause if we use public money to build those bathrooms? The answer is no. That question has been answered. Mm-hmm. But there were a line of cases. There's a long line of cases that are brought not under the Free Exercise Clause, but rather under the Establishment Clause that ask, under what circumstances is it acceptable for public money to go to religious schools? One of the big ones has to do with the kind of program we have in Milwaukee with the voucher program. Under what circumstances is it okay for public money to be used to pay religious school tuition? And the answer to that question, we have an answer. It comes out of a Cleveland program in a case called Zelman versus Simmons-Harris. And the answer is, as long as the money passes through private hands first, as long as there is genuine private choice, so that you give money to parents and they choose where to spend the money, then you don't have the government supporting religion. Critics of that case point out that in Cleveland at that time, 96% of eligible schools were Catholic, and that the total number of seats available in non-religious schools in the entire district was approximately 500. But the court is not concerned with those kind of fact questions. The court treats this as a very formalistic inquiry and asks, is it the case that the way the law works is the money goes through private hands first and they make a choice? And as long as the answer is yes, constitutionally, that's no problem.
What's the difference between, let's say, a private school and a private home? I mean, in terms of the application of the something like the ADA. I mean, the ADA can force or can compel a private school to have certain kind of facilities, but they can't force you in your own home to.
No, that's because almost everything – that's a slight exaggeration. The vast majority of the things that Congress does, including the ADA, they do under their Commerce Clause powers. And of course –
Oh, so if you're selling something, then you are subject to commerce laws and the ADA ties into
right.
that.
Right. That's right. I mean, I suppose if you're operating a business out of your home, the operation of that business might conceivably be subject to those sorts of regulations. But your living room is not.
At the top of the hour –
Unless you charge admission to your living room.
At the top of the hour, we mentioned a case involving could you bring rosary beads to school?
That's a really good example of this question of is there a requirement for accommodation for religious practice. So apparently, rosary beads have become gang symbols. And apparently it's not rare because we have cases of this kind in four different states that I know of, New York, Illinois, Texas, and right now there's one going on in New Hampshire. And in all of those cases, school districts have banned students from bringing rosary beads into public schools on the grounds that they are gang symbols. And suits have been filed by students claiming, no, for me, these are religious icons, religious symbols.
How do you sort through that?
Well, that's an awfully good question. Under Smith, you don't have to. That is, under Smith, the first obvious answer is this is a generally applicable law. It's not aimed at religion. But it's not a law that bans sort of symbols, for example. It bans rosaries specifically. And rosaries are specifically religious. So it's a little difficult to make that case fit quite so easily into the Smith rubric. It's just that we don't yet have a really good new rubric or a limiting principle for the Smith rule that we can identify. There's a lot of room. The same thing goes for the ADA case. It doesn't quite fit the Smith case in the sense that there's no criminal law involved here. There isn't something like drug use involved here. So it's not 100% clear whether that Smith principle of neutrality applies across the board or not. As far as we know, based on statements by the U.S. Supreme Court at present, that's true. But where it will go in the future is hard to say.
This slides us back over to free speech more, I suppose, that part of the First Amendment. But there have been, seems to me, a case or two. I don't know how far they've gotten in the court system where a word, the meaning of a word to one person versus another is the hinge for the whole case. In other words, a student who is expelled for saying, oh, don't be so gay.
Sure.
And in her context, she just meant foolish or silly. In other words, the meaning of the word continues to change with time and with usage. And how does the court keep up with that kind of thing?
Badly. Well, a more accurate answer is that the court tries to rely on general principles so as to avoid having to get into that. So, for example, while it's true, as we mentioned earlier, that under this Hazelwood case, school principals can censor school newspapers, it's also true that students in schools do have some free speech rights under a case called Ticker versus Des Moines. That case involved students who wanted to protest the Vietnam War by wearing black armbands. The current cases we're talking about involve students who want to carry rosary beads for either religious or gang-related reasons. There is a right of free speech that protects students in school, limited by the ability of the school to maintain order and discipline.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to have you back soon to talk about new First Amendment cases, because I think it's fair to say there always are going to be fascinating cases.
There always will be. We don't have a bong hits for Jesus case this year, as we did a couple of years ago, but I'm sure there's one like it coming down the road.
Waiting in the wings. Howard Schwaber, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air.